lays out the ends pretty well. The ways and the means are very uncertain. And of course, once you get into those details, that's when things get really controversial.
Space is going to be one of those theaters, which is a word that does not come up in this document. You know, it's a maneuver space now. It's not something that things just pass through. You know, we're going to fight and maneuver in space.
You certainly see the strategic logic of, you know, compressing on the hemisphere to achieve homeland defense, but it's not a complete logic.
Are we going to keep a permanent large naval force in the Caribbean? And if so, that means that we're going to be pulling those ships out of someplace else.
I think it's a deliberate aspect of strategic ambiguity, not to mention Taiwan in that context.
Hey, welcome back to the MWI podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Ambo, and on this episode, we're taking a look at the recently released U.S. National Defense Strategy. What does it signal about U.S. defense priorities? How will allies and partners interpret it? And what about adversaries and strategic rivals? To do so, I'm joined by three guests who bring a wealth of experience and really interesting perspectives to the discussion. Frank Hoffman is a retired Marine officer who served for years as a senior research fellow at the National Defense University and has worked on past national defense strategies. Mark Kansian is also a retired Marine officer and is currently a senior advisor with the Defense and Security Department at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Pat Sullivan is an Army colonel and the director of the Modern War Institute. Before we get to the discussion, as always, a couple quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, let's get to the conversation. Welcome back to the MWI podcast. I'm joined on this episode by three guests. Frank Hoffman, welcome, and thanks for being here.
Okay, great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Mark Kansian, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on the program.
And Pat Sullivan, thank you for being on this episode.
Yeah, thanks, John. Looking forward to it.
So listeners will have heard a bit about each of you in the intro leading into this episode. Suffice it to say, you each have very relevant experience, deep experience, and interesting perspectives to bring to bear on the subject that we're going to discuss today, which is the 2026 National Defense Strategy released, I think, about a week ago now. Before we get into kind of some of the details and get into the weeds, I guess I wanted to kind of set the stage by asking how we should evaluate a document like this. You know, it's called the National Defense Strategy, but I personally have questions, and I'm probably going to get hammered in the comments by, the strategy crowd out there. But I'm not so sure that it is a strategy document. Whether or not we, you know, think in terms of Lori Friedman's description of strategy as the art of creating power, or the sort of U.S. professional military education conceptualization, which is aligning ends, ways, and means with political objectives. So I guess to kind of kick off, Frank, I'll ask you first. Do you think we should evaluate this as a strategy document, as a sort of branding exercise? This is who we are and what our priorities are? Or how should we sort of frame it before we start examining it?
Well, first you have to understand some of the limitations. We're looking at a summary, which is a shell. The metaphor I would use is we're in the National History Museum, and we're looking at the skeleton of a dinosaur, and you're just seeing the framework or the bones. You're not seeing the flesh and the skin. You're not seeing it move very much. So it has limitations. I've had the privilege of working with Mr. Colby for a year inside the Pentagon on another defense strategy document. He's got a very good policy sense and is a good writer. And he's very capable of putting together a comprehensive strategy. This document doesn't necessarily reflect that at all. And the second point about these documents, they're written for sometimes specific audiences and sometimes very much plural audiences. So I look at the document and I see a page that, you know, Mark's characterized accurately as, you know, very partisan. There's an audience for that, probably up in the White House. There are pages that talk to allies outside. The page on China, I think, talks to allies in the Pacific who don't want a confrontational approach from us. So again, you have these multiple purposes. I like strategies, particularly the classified one, where you get to talk to the military and you talk about the shape and the purpose of the military and what you want them to be able to do and what priorities. I mean, you have to read the classified document, and you really, I think, to get that flavor, because this one is going to fall short on that for now. And I think that's true for the summary of the 2018 strategy that I was involved with. I think it's true for the summary of the 2022 strategy.
I wonder how much of that has to do with the fact that, right, the NDS is still sort of a new thing. It used to exist in this ecosystem of BURs and QDRs and other documents, and that have all sort of been brought together now. The NDS is the single thing. Well, those other documents had different purposes, and maybe the NDS, you know, is still trying to reflect the purposes of those other documents, of those other strategic documents, and which, you know, I guess, which are not necessarily to formulate a defense strategy.
Right. And I mean, we have a plethora of documents like this. You have the NSS, and I think there's very few air gaps between the defense strategy and the NSS. I think they integrated that fairly effectively. We remain to be seen what the National Military Strategy is going to do from the Joint Staff. I'm dubious about what the purpose of that particular document really does. But, you know, we do need a good defense strategy that provides the detail and provides the guidance that try to shape the services and the various audiences and the bureaucratic pressures in the near versus long term, and some of the trade-offs that need to be made. On the history of these newer NDSs, it's kind of interesting. The 2018 NDS was the first time that Congress had dictated 12 specific requirements that they wanted to see from a strategy. They wanted the assumptions to be explicit. They wanted the threats to be prioritized. They wanted investment priorities. They wanted operational challenges. And they wanted a risk analysis section. Some of these weren't normally in the published documents. And it remains to be seen. I want to see how close this NDS, you know, hews to that requirement. The Biden administration strategy did not list their assumptions at all. And there were some other aspects of the legislation that they didn't comply with. But one of the requirements that we had to satisfy, and I think this document is trying to satisfy, is Congress said, you know, make it classified so we can be explicit and conscious about risk and trade-offs, and then provide a public summary. And so that's what, you know, the last three documents are. They're shells.
Mark, you and your research assistant at CSIS published quite quickly after the NDS was released, a sort of by the numbers review, which is a very sort of quantitative approach to take to what to make of this NDS. It's fascinating for anybody who hasn't seen it. We'll include a link in the show notes to this episode. That is a really useful way of looking at how different this NDS is from its predecessors. Another way is really the structure and the framing of this, right? What are the lines of operation? What are the priorities or the objectives? And when you actually compare this against the 2022 Biden NDS, you know, this has four lines of effort. That had four defense priorities. That's how it characterized them. And a lot of them are pretty similar. Defend the homeland, deter China. There are also some distinctions, but I guess I want to ask you what, you know, if your sort of initial take on how much does this document differ from its predecessors? Not only the 2022 Biden NDS, but the 2018 Trump NDS as well. And which of those differences do you think is most fundamental, most important to focus on?
Yeah, we assess that there are radical changes, moderate changes, and some continuity. For the radical changes, the big one is the priority given to the homeland and hemispheric security. It takes up about half of the discussion. Homeland security has always been a concern since 9/11, and all of the strategy documents have talked about it. But this gives the hemisphere and the homeland a top priority on a variety of elements, you know, looking at counter drug, for example, counter immigration. We've seen that implemented with the movement of the Ford from the Med to the Caribbean. That left the region in the Middle East open. There was a gap. And then, of course, Iran. Then we had to push the Abraham Lincoln. So it reflects real changes in priority. Europe, of course, is harshly criticized here, and in the NSS, basically the Europeans are told to defend themselves with the U.S. as a backstop. doesn't see a conventional conflict with Russia as a major force driver. Now, there are some moderate changes. Of course, Golden Dome, which expands the existing missile and cruise missile defense efforts. North Korea is discussed as a threat, although it's mostly on the conventional side framed as a problem for South Korea and Japan, with the U.S. taking care of the nuclear and missile elements. There's strong support for Taiwan and for countering China. One of my colleagues, Bonnie Lin, pointed out that the word competition doesn't appear there, but clearly there is an element of countering China. One interest, and then on the Middle East, recognizing that the U.S. still has interest there. A couple of interesting omissions. Of course, all of the climate and DEI text is gone, but it doesn't talk at all about the all-volunteer force. The previous NDSs and QDRs always discussed how important that was and how important it was to maintain faith with service members and keep the all-volunteer force healthy. Nothing about that. There's some discussion, of course, about warrior ethos. It's very important for Hegseth, which really reflects the fact that this follows the NSS very closely. One gets the feeling that DOD didn't want to get ahead of the White House in any area, so kept very close. We note in our analysis that President Trump is cited 47 times. That's about twice a page, an extraordinary number. in 2018, I don't think the president was cited once in the document. Two things that are a little different from the NSS, maybe a little different in tone. One of them is Taiwan. There's an extended discussion about Taiwan in the NSS. Taiwan isn't really mentioned in the NDS, which is surprising considering how much attention it got in the NSS and about how important it was for U.S. security. And then the Middle East also makes a reappearance in the NSS. The Middle East is portrayed as an area that might be quiet now because Iran, Hamas, Hezbollah have been beaten down so much that the United States can shift its focus elsewhere. Here is a recognition that we're being pulled back.
Pat, what about you? Did you have any sort of high level broad thoughts when you read it for the first time? Did you come away with it with a sense of, hey, here's number one, two, and three, regardless of how it sort of frames the lines of effort and priorities and such? This is clearly what they're telling us are the most important things that the Defense Department is going to be focused on over the next 3+ years.
Yeah, so I certainly credit the administration for greater coherency in the document than perhaps I would have credited the foundational documents we would have seen in the first Trump administration. I mean, something that's consistently struck me about how America First policies have been expressed and to a certain degree operationalized is how consistent it actually is with all of the scholarly work that talks about hegemonic decline and how to manage it. You have internal measures that you can take and external measures you can take, all with an eye towards reestablishing the equilibrium between your realized cost of maintaining your position and the opportunity costs of a hegemonic, aspirant to take a shot at the title, so to speak. Those internal measures are, get better with your resources, get more efficient, and although I don't know that DOGE, the Department of Governmental Efficiency, actually was intended to accomplish that from a hegemonic decline perspective, you definitely see its utility when you do the comparison with the scholarly work. And then, concepts, externally of burden shifting and expansion towards more defensible borders, when you look at, dominance of the Western Hemisphere and, you know, ensuring that we have access to Greenland, the Panama Canal, et cetera, definitely speaks to that. Now, the challenge is, you know, coherency in the document is one matter, you know, coherency in the actual policy expressions and implementations are quite another. And when I talk to cadets at West Point, and when they are aware of this document, and they ask as future military practitioners, like, what is the import for them? You know, I was like, typically, you know, in my experience, even as I moved up through the ranks and increased levels of responsibility and got closer and closer to the levels of command that would be more directly influenced by this document and the NSS, it nonetheless, in my experience as a practitioner, was a bit of an abstraction. And I think moving forward for the military, it still probably will be until we see a virtuous linkage between the documents and things like the defense planning guidance, the resource allocation decisions, and most particularly the allocation priorities for global force management, and whether certain requirements from the combatant commands will still continue to be validated, because that's the driver of our global commitments and, in many respects, our resource decisions. And so until we see that linkage, and despite what I say about, you know, sort of crediting, you know, certain coherency and actually some scholarly consistency that I found a little bit surprising, it may still be an abstraction, as past national security strategies and national defense strategies have been abstractions, because, again, didn't necessarily match defense planning guidance or the allocation priorities for global force management.
I want to take a bit of a departure from the sort of from the script that I had in mind and circle back to something that Frank had said. Frank, you said that you're dubious about the value of the national military strategy, right? This is a set of three documents that are nested within one another: the NSS, the NDS, and then the NMS. Are you dubious about its value in a general sense or in the current context?
Just generically, with the formalization, you know, at one time the legislation required the national security strategy, as we've had for years, and put no requirements on what that would be other than the time it would be delivered. And then there was a national military strategy, which the chairman delivered. And when Mr. Rumsfeld came back in on his second tour, he was amazed to find some of the authorities and responsibilities that the chairman had, to include responsibility for issuing a national military strategy that would have his concurrence or approval. So Congress changed that and then required the three documents. And in my time in the Pentagon over the last 20 years, there's just no distinctive understanding between what a defense strategy does, and which I would sometimes have to explain to the Joint Staff, and what the military strategy ought to do. I think the military strategy ought to be scrapped, and we ought to have a universal defense strategy that covers all of that. Putting the chairman in the place, you know, the chairman is the only staff officer in Washington, D.C., or a commander, he's not even a commander, that has no executive authority to implement a strategy. You know, he's an advisor to the NSC, he's advisor to Congress and to the secretary. So him formulating a strategy that's not implemented just seems to make no sense to me.
But he is also statutorily expected, obligated to provide advice to those people, right? As an advisor.
Yeah, so you can see it as an advisory thing. Of course, he's also advising on the defense strategy too. And you know, in my time, you know, the chairman was intimately engaged. In fact, the task force that produced the 2018 strategy was co-chaired by a designated representative of the chairman and Mr. Colby. So, you know, that kind of collaboration goes on intensely, structure, process, and product. And the chairman provides best military advice on the strategy itself at the end game as well. So I just don't see a value on it. I've talked to people on the Hill. It's one of these things that lives on, keeps people busy, I guess. But the value added and the disconnect sometimes that can carry another opportunity for air gaps, since we're trying to implement the NDS. And there is an implementation plan for the NDS. There is not an implementation plan for the national military strategy, because, again, it's not designed to be an implementable strategy. So I don't know why it's even called a strategy.
it is, you know, if we think about what a scenario that the Goldwater-Nichols Act envisions, which is civilian policymakers say, I want to do X, and senior military personnel in their role to advise on this say, we don't have the capability to do X without, you know, running risks A, B, and C. Is the national military strategy then an opportunity for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, for the Joint Chiefs generally, to also perhaps take a slightly different tack away from the national defense strategy? Or is that just, you know, sure, in theory, but it's never going to happen in practice?
Yeah, that was one of my lines today was Yogi Berra's great saying that in theory, there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. It's even more compounded as a problem. Congress requires the chairman to issue a risk assessment. And that risk assessment is not predicated upon the defense strategy that the White House has approved and the Secretary of Defense is trying to implement. The risk assessment that Congress gets is on the chairman's strategy, which again is not implementable. The budget's not supposed to align with that. The budget's supposed to align with the NDS. And so the risk assessment to me is somewhat skewed, but it does provide you, particularly the COCOMs, an opportunity to frame their understanding of risk in their particular theater, which again is a straw that each combatant commander looks at. But it's again useful to have that perspective. But again, some interest in getting the risk assessment to assess the risk in the NDS independently, which the alternative NDS commission that Congress sets up every year also provides a useful perspective from the outside over the last, I think, four iterations of the defense strategy. So that's something else to fix, is to have Congress dictate that the risk assessment they get be based on the defense strategy, which is a more holistic understanding of support, industrial issues, policy, and force structure guidance, and the budget, I think, is more comprehensive than doing a risk assessment on the military strategy alone.
Yeah, if I could jump in. It's impossible for the national military strategy to come out differently from the national defense strategy or the national security strategy. You know, the secretary won't tolerate that. The White House wouldn't tolerate that. The Congress might be interested in that, but it's not going to happen. And, you know, they'll scrub all those differences out as the documents are being prepared. Now, back in the 90s, when Shali Khashvili was the chairman, he was setting up almost a parallel joint staff process so that every step there was a joint staff document that paralleled what the Secretary of Defense's staff was doing. But that died out because, you know, Rumsfeld, for example, would tolerate that. So not to reinforce what Frank said, not clear what value added there is for a national military strategy that can't deviate from the national defense strategy.
If I could make an additional comment, I do find it somewhat interesting that, you know, national defense as a concept and a construct, you know, came mid-century with, you know, the awareness that, you know, global security, how you advance national interests within a global security environment was, you know, involved a lot more than, you know, just raw materialist power conversion strategies that, you know, you perhaps or hopefully pursue in a rationalist type way. And it's not just simply, you know, a military discussion for security. There is, you know, an economic discussion. There's a social discussion. There's any sector conceivably that, you know, could be addressed either in governmental functions or international relations contribute to this idea of national defense. And yet in this discussion, and then you also look at the history of the provenance and the interconnection between, you know, NDSs and national military strategies. This is still focused on the Department of War, nay, defense. This is still focused on the military instrument of power. And when you look at the lines of effort, and particularly the recreation of the arsenal of democracy, one of those pretexts is leveraging and AI economy, and then establishing dominance within that. But that in turn is predicated on energy security and energy investments. It was striking that given that dependence, that was not addressed at all. And again, when you contrast that with the meaning of national defense and what actually motivated the term mid-century, I just find that omission very telling.
It's been almost a decade now, I think, since General Dunford sort of conceptualized or gave a name to what we were all sort of collectively thinking about the threat environment, the 4+1, right? China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, and countering violent extremism. These were the priorities. That's remained fairly static. And in fact, if you look at this new NDS, the security environment section is made up of six subsections. Four of them are those four state actors: China, Russia, Iran, North Korea. And that's why I mentioned the fact that while there is, and Mark, you mentioned that there are big differences, small differences, and continuities. I think that that is an important continuity. One of the other two is homeland and hemisphere. So I'm curious if anybody has any thoughts about, there's clearly, this administration has clearly prioritized, attention paid toward things that are happening in the Western Hemisphere, the sort of reemergence of the Monroe Doctrine. By lumping those two things together, homeland and hemisphere, and the homeland has been, a feature of all of our NDSs, for years. But by putting those together, is it your sense that the administration conceptualizes its actions in this hemisphere as fundamentally about protecting the homeland?
Yeah, I'll start. I mean, I think so. And there was a Brookings scholar in response to the National Security Strategy when it was published in December that spoke to this issue, and the name escapes me. But the key point that they brought up in their analysis is that the conflation of homeland defense with hemispheric security, recognizes the geostrategic advantage that the United States has enjoyed for quite some time about being, separated from the rest of the world by, two vast oceans and having friendly borders to its north and south. Yet, pairing the two back together, presumes that advantage and the continued utility of it, but doesn't necessarily recognize just how much smaller the world has become, and is there false comfort that we are associating with said vastness of those two oceans? And then again, Arctic security, focus on Greenland, that all makes sense as we open up potentially international straight lines through the Northwest Passage or what have you, but again, that just reinforces the idea that vastness is no longer as useful as it was in the past.
I think the answer is yes. They've clearly frame hemispheric security in terms of defending the homeland. And there are two aspects. One is counter drug, the other is counter immigration. But there's also the notion of keeping the Russians, Iranians, and Chinese out of the hemisphere. That's the Monroe Doctrine piece of it. All of those the administration has talked to. An interesting thing, though, is how much effort that will take. And that's one of the reasons that I would love to have some force tables and some specifics about forces. Are we going to keep a permanent large naval force in the Caribbean? And if so, that means that we're going to be pulling those ships out of someplace else. Are we going to redesign part of the Army for border security? They've hinted at that in the past. One interesting thing that was missing is the use of the military in domestic law enforcement. That's, of course, been a huge issue over the last number of weeks, number of months, not mentioned in the NDS, except about the military helping with immigration, but not about law enforcement in cities. The other thing is we have a chart that shows that the number of personnel that are involved with hemispheric security and homeland security is not very large. huge political and policy implications, not a lot of troops involved. So again, love to see some force tables and get a sense, okay, is this about what we can expect, in which case other forces will remain where they are and won't be a whole lot of change? Or, you know, are we going to pull a lot of forces back so that, you know, what we're estimating about 15,000, you know, maybe that will be a much larger number.
I see some value in thinking about hemispheric defense holistically and thinking about particularly things like missile defense, cooperation with Canada on NORAD and things, and things we're going to do, I think, in law enforcement security on the southern border with Mexico. So I think it's important to think like that. I think bureaucratically, it's also useful for the department. I think the department wants to focus on more of its traditional military focuses, things like missile defense. And I think those are going to be the big ticket items within that line of effort. I think bureaucratically, we're where we are right now with Venezuela. It was useful for the department to blur and expand the notion of homeland security. And that's why the Western Hemisphere is kind of tucked in there, probably somewhat belatedly over the last few months. I don't think that was where the department was starting from. You made a very interesting point about the traditional adversaries that General Dunford started with, you know, kind of the 4+1. I was once tasked to come up with what would be the next one to that, and I failed at that task miserably. But one of the things that doesn't come across in the strategy right now is the notion of congruence, convergence, and collusion between some of these actors that we didn't see in the past. And the strategy still kind of reflects them as isolated actors as opposed to somewhat more collaborative. They're not allies. It's not an unlimited partnership, no matter what Mr. Xi and Putin say. But there is more interaction and mutual support. A lot of it's bilateral, supporting Russia right now. But that aspect doesn't come across. And I think it increases the threat concept that we need to think about rather than the priority given to China as a pacing threat in isolation from the rest.
You know, Homeland Defense has, you know, been the priority as long as, you know, I've been in the military, you know, for approaching 30 years now. And, you know, having it, you know, be prioritized in the way that it is with both the NSS and the S is, in some respects, you know, not a change. How it's envisioned, of course, as we just discussed, is a bit of a change. You certainly see the strategic logic of, you know, compressing on the hemisphere to achieve homeland defense, but it's not a complete logic. If you accept the proposition that homeland defense has always been a priority, and you've had, you know, previous foundational documents, you know, past administrations, NSSs and NDSs, you know, the intervention forward, the maximalist, expression of American power abroad, you know, to advance various equities associated with the rules-based international order that we, at least in the introduction, you know, reject somewhat in the NDS. A lot of that was designed to fix problems forward before they could metastasize to threaten the homeland. Now, that created its own set of problems, but, you know, again, given the increasing smallness of the world or the decreasing utility of the vastness of two big oceans, then we do have to be cognizant at least of the potential of the problems we are no longer solving forward are potentially larger and more complex when we do have to address them a little bit closer ashore.
I like the way Colonel Sullivan's, you know, posited that. I think the last two defense strategies tried to make clear that, you know, the American way of war, power projection from the United States, with the homeland assumed to be a sanctuary and completely uncontested logistic lines of communication to the theater of engagement, is no longer the, you know, geopolitical reality that we operate in. The homeland is not a sanctuary, and critical infrastructure, cybersecurity, and throughput are going to be more challenged in the next contest. Unfortunately, with the Western Hemisphere and the Caribbean aspects, some of that aspect is clouded a little bit, except for the cybersecurity element. And for our listeners, you know, looking up Bolt Typhoon and understanding where China is inside our critical infrastructure would be warranted a few minutes of everybody's time.
If I could add one more thing about simultaneity, which Frank raised at the beginning, there's a section on simultaneity, and there's one sentence that recognizes that there might be some collusion among adversaries, but then it stops and doesn't go further. Maybe they didn't want to get in front of the White House because the rest of the section talks about the allies and the criticism of the allies.
Yeah, I actually wanted to ask you about that because it has long been a planning assumption, sometimes I think more aspirational than anything else, but that the U.S. military must be prepared to fight two theater conflicts, right?
Nearly simultaneously.
The simultaneity problem is effectively that you know, China could launch some aggressive action against Taiwan at the same time as Russia undertakes some aggression in Eastern Europe, for instance. That's effectively a two-theater conflict then. But because that section is called the simultaneity problem and implications for allied burden sharing. And Mark, as you pointed out, it only mentions one sentence about simultaneity and that sort of coordinated action. And I think it suggests that it's really used as a way to bring up the importance of alliance burden sharing. But I wonder if it's also could be read as an acknowledgement that, you know, as long as we've talked about being prepared to fight a two-theater war, in reality, given the advances of the Chinese military, given, you know, what Russia has shown it's willing to accept from, you know, an attritional war standpoint, that if the United States military ended up in a war with both of those, that we truly could not do it without allies and partners. I wonder if any of you had, I guess, thoughts about the subject, the way that it talks about allies, which is, you know, allies and partners have been a feature of every one of these NDSs that we've seen, but this one talks about them differently. It really is sort of more forward leaning in terms of we need more from you.
I've written two articles on this that published at the Army War College. The first article before the NDS of published in 2016, I recommended we go to a two war construct in which one would be a unilateral and one would be an alliance based kind of an approach. And the SecDef rejected that. He sent for me. We had a conversation. I don't know if I understood his logic at the time, but he rejected the notion of the two MTW. And he said, we're going to have allies in both. And he didn't want to create a construct in which allies wouldn't accept their burden sharing kind of thing. So I think that was useful. But I've recently published a piece in 2025 on the two MTW thing. And I picked up on John's comment about the mythology. There's a lot of folks in town who advocate for that. And I think they think that having a double yardstick assumes you're going to get, Congress is going to give you the end strength for these two scenarios. You're going to get all the training and readiness resources for that. You're going to get the recruiting money for that. You're going to be able to equip all that. And I worry about having 80% of the people and 80% of the equipment and 80% of the training you want to have. So I labeled that, you know, the resulting mythology of a two-war construct is you end up with a lose-lose scenario, and then you're not going to be prepared for the China threat, and you're not going to be prepared for something else that might be simultaneous. And I had another twist in this article for people who want to have a three theater. You hear about three theaters. You know, in the next conflict, if we have a major dust up with a significant power, we're going to have multiple theaters. The homeland is going to be one of the theaters. Space is going to be one of those theaters, which is a word that does not come up in this document, that we're vastly undermanned and under equipped for. You know, it's a maneuver space now. It's not something that things just pass through. You know, we're going to fight and maneuver in space. And I'm sure the classified document will pick up, you know, more on that. But any war with a major power is going to be a multi-theater, multi-domain contest. And so you need to assess risk differently than we have in the past. And having two very similar scenarios with very similar force structures that are inherently conventional focuses all your money into those conventional boxes and hopefully eliminates the risk. But then it exposes your industrial base, your inventories, your readiness levels, your modernization capabilities, and your space and nuclear modernization capacities, all of which have been underfunded for the last decade. So again, the two war construct is something very important to deal with, both in theory. In theory, it's a good thing. In practice, I don't find it to be very useful. And I think it ignores the risk and the trade-offs that are made to support it.
With the two-war construct and, you know, envisioning that one of them is primarily going to be the responsibility of, you know, allies or partners, you know, the document does say that we would, you know, support the second war, that the ally-led war in, quote, I think a limited fashion. In my headcanon, that suggests the high demand, limited resources that the United States can uniquely provide. Yet those same high demand, limited resources would be needed in the war that we're fighting. And it's all the stuff that is managed or requires global integration through functional combatant commands. And so I am, again, limited support through limited resources. I think every time we look at the simultaneity problem, we envision, you know, going, you know, Winchester on conventional capability in trying to support both theaters. And I frankly think that's the least of our problems, particularly if we're, you know, trying to shift responsibilities to allies and only enable them with, you know, sort of some of the exquisite capabilities that we have as a military. And the second issue is anytime we're talking about, you know, alliances fighting to advance shared interests is the principal agent problem. And how do you manage that?
I think this NDS is explicit about that second conflict in a way that the two previous NDSs had sort of danced around it. You know, they talked about one major conflict and then deter a second one. Here, they're quite explicit that, you know, okay, our allies are going to have to take care of that second one. We'll provide some support. Now, it would be great if someone did some analysis to say, okay, what does that mean? What support are we going to give them so we don't end up in this problem that, you know, we've just heard about, that is that, you know, we're building armored brigades when what they really need, you know, or some, you know, space systems or ballistic missile defense or, whatever. Maybe that'll end up in the classified, you know, maybe it'll end up in the next budget documents. But, you know, it's a key element for building our forces, because otherwise we'll build two similar force structures for two wars and, you know, not have them aligned with the strategy.
Frank, you mentioned the sort of dearth of references to space. And while I know that sort of a strictly qualitative, you know, control F search for words in a document like this is not at a perfect metric, but just bear with me for a second. There are two mentions of space in this 2026 NDS. The first is that there are threats to the homeland, including nuclear threats, as well as a variety of conventional strike and space, cyber, and electromagnetic warfare capabilities. The second, again, is that Russia poses undersea space and or has undersea space and cyber capabilities that it could employ against the U.S. homeland. So it talks about space twice, but only in the context of homeland defense. Now, this is from an administration who, in its previous incarnation, created the Space Force, clearly emphasized how important space is as a warfighting domain, that it needs its own independent service, quasi-independent service under the Air Force. Related to that, cyber. If you look at the 2022 cyber, the 2022 NDS, cyber comes up 35 times. Space, something like 40. In this NDS, the word cyber, or in its various incarnations, cyber warfare, cybersecurity, comes up 6 times. These are the two most emergent warfighting domains, and yet they're not really discussed, despite the fact that, as I mentioned, the Trump administration clearly prioritizes space, and the fact that we are now at a point where, you know, we have a robust sort of organizational infrastructure around the cyber domain in ways that we didn't have even 4 years ago or 8 years ago when these previous documents were released. So what do you make of the fact that there's sort of little attention paid to these two domains?
I think a lot of the space conversation will be well covered in the classified area. And there's an assumption in a lot of people's mind that the Golden Dome aspect, has a lot of investment in space and not just in, you know, interceptors, you know, ground-based interceptors in Alaska or Greenland or Canada or whatever. So I think it'll be adequately covered there, but it needs to be adequately covered. To me, it's an operative theater in any conflict, and it's not just in support of the homeland.
So what if we look at this document from, as you know, I can't remember who mentioned it early in the discussion, but this was sort of written for an audience of one. But it's not only going to be read by an audience of one, it's going to be read by allies, it's going to be read by rivals and adversaries, strategic competitors. It's going to be read by our own, you know, service leaders, combatant commands. So I guess if you look at it, let's start with allies. What should allies make of this? Is there anything in it that's really going to strike them as new, given recent events?
I mean, I would come out strongly and say no. You know, for all the discussion about burden sharing and the free rider problem, and you know, alliances being characteristic of like larger collective action problems. You know, irrespective of, you know, what is being expressed and, you know, what leverage through, you know, word and, diplomatic exchange and mil-to-mil exchange that, you know, the administration is trying to levy, you know, this has been a consistent message, at least since the Obama administration. And, you know, we're seeing just really kind of just differences on the margins on how the leverage is being expressed. Moreover, this idea that, you know, we're providing most of the public good of security through defense spending for NATO, and that allows the European members to, you know, focus their dollars elsewhere, we would be spending that money anyway. So yes, it contributes to the public good of security for NATO, but, you know, NATO members have to recognize that not most of what we're spending in the aggregate is not necessarily for European defense. And, you know, another problem within the collective action problem beyond free ridership is, you know, for the smaller, less powerful nations, you know, the potential commitment problem associated with, you know, is the United States going to show up in response to our Article 5 declaration? Again, these dynamics and any of the attendant incentive structures, there's nothing new there. And this is stuff that the alliance members have had to grapple as a consequence of membership. And as long as NATO survives, I think these factors will still be there. And, you know, Mark talked about continuity. This is going to be an element of continuity with any number of successor administrations, just, again, with different expressions probably on the margins on how we are seeking to share or shift burden.
Yeah, there's no question that the United States has complained about the lack of burden sharing by our allies, particularly NATO. You can go back to the very beginning of the alliance, and the U.S. is complaining the Europeans aren't doing enough. That is a threat of continuity. There are two attitudes that you see coming out of the administration. One of them I saw yesterday, it was Rubio in front of the Foreign Relations Committee, and he put forth a pretty traditional view about the alliances. He was talking about NATO. He said, you know, we're committed to NATO, but we're pivoting to the Pacific. He didn't use pivoting, you know, but we're focusing on the homeland and the Pacific. We can't be everywhere, and the Europeans have to step up, you know, because of these new demands on our forces. Now, that's, you know, pretty close to what other administrations have said, maybe taking it another step. But then you get real contempt for the allies, saying, well, they never helped us at all, you know, ignoring, you know, the sacrifices that some of them made. And that's, I think, part of what we saw with Greenland. You know, a part of the administration was quite willing to, you know, shake the alliance over issues that really didn't seem all that important. So you've got this bifurcation here. We'll see how that plays out over the remaining 3 years.
Yeah, if I can add in, a lot of the administration's language, which is belligerent or pejorative, is going to be tempered, I think, a little bit by Congress. Congress has put limitations on restrictions in the European Defense Initiative or deterrence initiatives and on some of the troop withdrawals. And so there'll be some tension from Congress. But I think Congress is more supportive of NATO than the administration. If we could switch gears a little bit, as negative as it is on the European side, I think it's a little more neutral on allies in the Pacific. And I think allies don't want a confrontational approach. I think the Japanese and the South Koreans have a lot of economic interests with China. A lot of other countries like Thailand or Vietnam have economic interests, and they want to be defended. They want to work constructively with the United States. I think the language that's in there is talks to them as much as it talks to Beijing about not wanting a conflict per se, or a very aggressive form of competition. And the language on the first island chain, even though it doesn't explicitly address Taiwan, I think it's understood that the linchpin of the first island chain is the retention of Taiwan's independent status. And I think it's a deliberate aspect of strategic ambiguity not to mention Taiwan in that context. But I think the region will interpret that section differently than those of us who might be a little more hawkish on China and its dramatic military modernization that needs to be aggressively constructed against. There's a phrase in the strategy that always rubs me the wrong way, and I think we took it out of every version of the last two NDSs, but the phrase favorable balance of power is an oxymoron. You either have a balance or you don't have a balance. If you have a favorable balance of power, you could be perceived as a threat to China because you have more power than China has. So I sometimes like position of strength. That's an old NITSI term a lot of defense strategists use. But even that could be threatening to China. But I welcome the language on China that's in the strategy. It'll be interesting to see what the classified breakdown talks about. And again, how the resources are allocated in that Pacific region, if we can make more progress than we've made in the last 8 years, which has been unsatisfactory.
Returning to the NATO and European discussion, just more for just comment, I do wonder, you know, what Lord Ismay would say, you know, back when NATO was founded, pejoratively, you know, he described the founding principles as, you know, keep the Russians out of Western Europe and, you know, keep the Germans down. Now, granted, that was post-World War II, you know, sensibility and very, very raw historical memory that he was responding to. But I do wonder if the policymakers and the strategy authors do envision like an upper limit for how much they would want Germany especially to like rearm and establish, you know, materialist type power. Because, you know, you could imagine an emergent system where, you know, perhaps maybe not the EU proper working as a combined entity, but, you know, a bunch of strong states in Europe, at least strong in the aggregate, now cohering around Germany to serve as a balancer both for the United States and China, because that is more aligned with their interests. And, you know, when you consider that in the aggregate, you know, you don't need too many European countries to work together to be a peer-wise economy or military with us in China, you know, that's a form of competition moving forward that perhaps we would not want.
Yeah, you know, that's an independent Europe acting as an independent actor collectively does not have the military capability to sort of compete with the United States, to compete with China. But they do have some of the underlying building blocks, right? The economic strength, which can be turned into a sort of unified defense industrial base, which can then turn into military power. And so I think that is an interesting aspect of the discussion. We've talked now, though, about sort of what this looks like from allies' perspectives. What does it look like from adversaries' perspectives? Is there any sense that, you know, the powers that be in Beijing or in the Kremlin or in Tehran or Pyongyang are looking at this and fundamentally think, like, you know, this is an eye-opening moment for them? Or is it all sort of, is this one of the continuities, Mark, that you mentioned?
Well, I'll start with Europe. I think this might be a relief to Putin and Russia, in the sense that the United States is so clearly moving back. And of course, our activities around Greenland have shaken the alliance. So it's not as much as Putin would hope for. You know, he would like NATO to be shattered. But you know, it I think for him it was an encouraging step. Not so much for Iran. North Korea, you know, maybe there's called out as an adversary, but mostly a problem for South Korea and Japan. You know, that might take a little of the pressure off, although the U.S. is going to be very involved with missile defense and nuclear.
If I could jump in, I think Putin might be insulted because, in essence, Russia is declared not to be much of a problem from the United States perspective. Mm-hmm. The graph in the strategy showing the relative GDP of the EU versus Russia is very telling. You know, it's a 10-to-1 economic power ratio. It's very telling that Europe has the potential. It also has the demographics. And I think it also has a S&T base that's could be invested in and be adequate. So, but Putin won't be, I think, satisfied by that. I think the Chinese will be a little more comfortable with some of that language. And when you couple it with whatever comes out of the economic and trade discussions, you know, we may see a dampening of escalatory language in that region. And I think there's a little bit of an olive branch in a sense in that. I think that's what it's intended to both allies and to adversaries in the Pacific, that we're not looking to be terribly aggressive. But, you know, for the hawks in town, the trade negotiations, the loosening of export controls on chips, the TikTok deal, you know, some other language and things we're doing with the Chinese don't indicate that we're going to compete as aggressively in the economic and S&T dimension. I think that's one of the continuities between the Biden administration and the Trump administration, is that they understand that the competition with China is, in essence, you know, economic national power and science and technology developments is the future for both our prosperity and our security. And we should be intensely interested in winning that portion of the competition. That's kind of muted in the strategy, except for it's covered pretty well in the defense industrial base conversation about innovation, innovators, stimulation of more futuristic and emerging technologies comes across. And I think the Chinese will read that section very carefully.
Yeah, just two thoughts. You know, I'm not a China expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I thought back after reading the document, I thought back to, you know, John Eikenberry's still fairly recent writings about China's, you know, emergent place in the world and his characterization of it as a liberal hegemony. And this is a very power-centric document. You know, there's very clear signaling that's being sent to China, but China's view of power is vastly different than ours. And so I do wonder, like, how those signals would be, you know, interpreted, or if if they have the impact that we intend. The other thing is, with hemispheric security and closing off certain things, or, you know, presumably access to Venezuelan oil and, you know, international straight lines within the region, you know, particularly the transiting of material through the Panama Canal, you know, that induces that puts a trade security question back to the Chinese, and they will respond accordingly and perhaps just double down on their diplomatic and trade engagements in other parts of the world, parts of the world that we are basically still seeding in this document. You know, when you look at the how little is talked about, you know, Africa and you know, the continued disengagement from the Middle East. You know, for all the discussion about Belt Road Initiative and the New Silk Road, I think people forget, like, why it was first developed by Deng Xiaoping, you know, now several decades ago. It was meant to solve the so-called Malacca dilemma, you know, the fact that they were dependent on oil coming from the Middle East that had to transit the Straits of Malacca, and we have the special relationship with Singapore and a strong alliance with Malaysia. And so BRI is meant to diversify their their sources of needed imports. Well, when we restrict things from the hemisphere, then their response to available markets is going to be predictable. And so as part of global competition, will we position ourselves back in those theaters to confront that? That would be an interesting evolution to map once we see this strategy operationalized.
Frank mentioned the, I guess, the fourth line of effort, which is the defense industrial base sort of reinvigoration. And I want to circle back to that before we kind of close out with some top-level thoughts again. Before I do, I just want to ask, you know, we've talked now about this, you know, how this will be perceived among allies and partners, how it will be perceived among adversaries, strategic rivals. What about internally? You know, are there service chiefs that look at this and are seeing dollar signs because this is going to mean an increase in budgets for their service? Or are there combatant commanders who are looking at this and saying, hey, we should be prepared for an influx of capabilities into the theater that we're responsible for?
I addressed this in my comments that I published at War on the Rocks, but one of my 12 checklist items for strategies is, you know, does this document provide a compelling and persuasive argument for either reform or additional resources? And I don't get a big lift out of this document, with the exception of the defense industrial base, which has a sense of urgency. Not a lot of negativity, but you know, the president's talked about a $1.5 trillion defense budget for 27, which is, I think, comical. If you gave the Defense Department, you know, $500 billion, you know, fresh dollars next year, there's just no way anybody could practically spend it. But over time, you could ramp to that, and that would get us to almost 5% of GDP, which is what we're asking of some allies. But I just don't sense in the document. One gets the notion that we're going to focus more on the Pacific, and that's LOE2, and LOE3 is justifying and paying for that. The only areas of lift, you know, are the expensive Golden Dome options, which Mark covered in his paper very well. I'll split the baby, you know, this could be a $1.1 trillion expense, and it still might increase the defense of the American population a small percentage point after that expense. But other than the industrial base and the missile defense item, I just don't see an argument for why we should give the department, I think, the kind of money the department needs. It needs it for inventory. It needs it for protracted conflict. It needs it for simultaneity. And I don't think this document provides that argument. I don't know if it justifies the current FY25 budget.
Not even for, say, Southcom and the increased emphasis on hemispheric activity and operations. I mean, if I'm the Southcom commander, I see that and think, hey, my responsibilities are only going to continue to increase, which means I should expect an influx of capabilities in order to fulfill those responsibilities.
Yeah, Mark covered that in his paper. I think you'd go from zero allocated forces to some 10 to 15,000 kind of allocation. And that's just what's kind of stripped out of Europe. So the Europe force allocation can pay for that particular LOE. Again, you'll see the trade-offs, I guess, in the budget and in the classified document. But as a summary going to Congress, you know, to just propel me to want to do a lot more, it doesn't provide a lot of detail for that, other than missile defense and the industrial base, both of which are very large, you know, ticket items, particularly if you want to get to the shipbuilding and the munitions inventories that we may need. Those are large lifts, and I'm hoping the classified document explains that to Congress.
Yeah, until we see the virtuous, like I said at the beginning, the virtuous connection of this document to the other downstream elements of the PPB&E process, I mean, again, this remains a bit of an abstraction. And irrespective of what any administration publishes for its foundational documents, you know, exercising their prerogative, the incentive structure for the combatant commanders doesn't change. You know, they're still going to be, you know, seeking a way to maximize their share of the fiscal and the force allocation pie through the requirements they seek to get validated and provided through the joint staff. And, you know, whether those are aligned with, you know, priorities that are either explicitly stated or implied by either the NSS, the NDS, or the implementing military strategy, you know, that's a matter of constant debate, and it belies the nature of incentive structures.
Yeah, the confusing thing is that the document appears aimed at a level budget. You know, that talks about we're going to take forces out of Europe, you know, maybe de-emphasize Korea. We're going to put maybe a little more on the hemisphere, and doesn't make an argument for, you know, why are you adding $500 billion or whatever the number turns out to be to the defense budget? As Frank pointed out, that, you know, there's clear language that would say we're going to increase our efforts in the hemisphere, but doesn't say how, or, you know, will we continue the level of naval presence, and therefore that requires, you know, X number of additional ships. Are we going to beef up, you know, ground forces or air forces in the Caribbean? Doesn't say that. So one of the questions that we asked at the end of our paper was, you know, what are these large budgets for? And you don't get a really good answer from the NDS.
Yeah, I agree with Mark's take. And it'll be interesting to see what the crosswalk is between the strategy and the budget. John, you mentioned a point about Southcom. I think the issue is more SOCOM than Southcom. Mm. And the paper, at least the unclassified summary, is somewhat silent on the role of unconventional warfare. I expect a lot of proxy forces. They've been reduced in the Middle East, but I think that both security assistance and special operations are a tool that this administration likes. And I'm sure in the classified version, there's some language that will address that. That might be an area that, again, doesn't get an increase, but certainly going to be a busy group that may need some resources or special capabilities.
I think every administration, at least for the past quarter century, has quite liked special operations capabilities and turning to that as the tool of choice whenever there's a thorny problem to solve. Now, I want to turn to the final LOE, and you've mentioned it a couple times, Frank, the Defense Industrial Base. The introduction to this NDS ends with the sentence, "All Department of War components will adhere to the guidance and direction enclosed." Speaking specifically of the Defense Industrial Base, if all components within the department do in fact adhere to the guidance and direction enclosed, is that sufficient to send the appropriate demand signals to the Defense Industrial Base in terms of what we need, how much we need it? A handful of months ago, I recorded an episode of this podcast with Becca Wasser from the Center for New American Security about a report that she had co-authored on the Defense Industrial Base and how that's just changed so much from, you know, raw materials, intensive sort of steel-based industrial manufacturing to software and a lot more sort of intangible components that are what we'll really need. If you look at this and specifically that LOE on reinvigorating the Defense Industrial Base, are those demand signals sent to the private sector actors that we need to be communicating with to make sure that they're providing what we're going to need?
Well, the only signal that the industrial base responds to is resource allocations. As Mark and I are both money guys and business school graduates who've worked in the budgeting world, and it's an expensive proposition. And I'll get into some detail on the shipbuilding, but you know, we are being outbuilt, you know, like 100-1 or 80-1 in China when it comes to shipbuilding, and we've let our industrial base, you know, atrophy. There are estimates, you know, we need 100,000 or 200,000 new people working in the shipbuilding industry, and that's a heavy lift. And we have to decide whether we're going to compete on that kind of number or what it is we need to be cost effective. We can't do everything. But I did think the signals in the defense industrial base sort of satisfied me. I was worried for a while when I hear phrases like arsenal of democracy. I recall a really good paper done by Tyler Hacker at CSBA on, you know, the myths and model of the arsenal of democracy. And, you know, are we trying to rebuild the Cold War? And we're going to help out airplane production or tank manufacturing or 155 shells, some of which we obviously need, or are we going to incentivize the creation of an arsenal of democracy for the 21st century, which would be software centric, would be about unmanned machines, would be about additive manufacturing. So the language in the strategy that talks about, you know, unique or non-traditional vendors, I read as Silicon Valley, which has a voice in this administration, both in the department and in the White House. As appropriately balanced between, you know, the old and the new, And to me, it was the only page that had a positive vision and a sense of urgency in the language that would kind of help me want to spend more on that. But again, the dollar amount is far more more significant than the document suggests. And that's where a lot of money could be soaked up if the administration was to win a fight with Congress to come up with the resources. But I totally agree with Mark. The document to me is more conscious about trade-offs, maintaining a status quo. It doesn't support the suggestion the president made in one speech. I haven't seen anybody carry that forward in any way, or anybody on the House or Senate, you know, pick up that kind of language and look for it. There are folks like Senator Wicker and my friends at the NDS Commission that would like to see that kind of money being spent, but we don't have sources for revenue for that kind of activity. And we are $32 trillion in the hole today. So it'll be some very hard questions in an election year in the House to address that kind of a lift. And so I think the administration, at least in DOD, is a little more conscious of the trade-offs. They could always take more money and do some good things with it. But I think they're prepared to make those trade-offs and to hopefully live up to the priorities they set forth.
I've got to get this episode edited and out soon before we're $33 trillion in the hole.
That's $7 million a minute, you know.
Mark, you had some thoughts?
Yeah. Two quick items. I mean, the first, building on what Frank said, is that the money has to be sustained. One of the points that industry makes to us and many others is, you know, one-time shot of money, you know, is nice, but that's not going to expand your industrial base. You know, you have to make commitments for multi-years to continue that past the current administration. But to give the current administration its due, you know, they have put out some changes in the acquisition process, removing, you know, some of the requirements to try to get it moving more quickly. You know, that may speed things up. It's always the risk that, you know, you took out one of the safeguards and now, you know, one of your programs goes running off the rails. But they have done the things or some of the things that you would need to do to implement a more responsive industrial base.
Yeah, anything that Secretary Hegseth can do to address the pathologies in the defense acquisition system wherein we over time seem to be getting less for more, I think is time well spent. I know he's been on his roadshow to give various speeches to emergency industry partners, and so I'm excited to see the returns on that. I having been at, you know, the Hill and Valley Forum last year, AUSA conference a couple times recently, you know, you see within the defense industry, and going back to this idea of incentive structures, you know, that they'll see developments in the operational space, meaning between Russia-Ukraine war, Gaza, Nagorno-Karabakh. You know, they'll make some inferences about potential, you know, future fights in the Indo-Pacific. And they'll draw their immediate materialist lessons and then, you know, try to establish competitive advantage within the R&D and sales market by integrating what they perceive to be sort of the new technologies or these great leaps forward with respect to again, you know, military technical advantage. And you know, you go out to any of the arms shows and, you know, there will be AI dust sprinkled everywhere, irrespective of, you know, what the platform is and what its intended purpose. I am a little bit concerned about, you know, AI being oversold, also perhaps over-threatened as far as, you know, what we are seeing from China's investment decisions and what they're developing. I would just caution, you know, our senior leaders and our developers to not squander the advantage that we have gained over the past 25 years, which is systems integration and operational testing of proven systems. And I think our investment decisions moving forward, you know, where appropriate, yeah, let's seek the great leaps forward with respect to, but you know, that technology has to be proven, but you know, most of our investments prudentially should be recapitalizing proven systems that leverage our extant advantage for operational testing and systems integration. And, you know, when with our visit to Ukraine this past summer, you know, talking to the Ukrainians, like what's most effective in a drone and sensor saturated environment. You know, we talked about the emerging domains for cyber and space. They're actually going back to older technologies, and those are proving to be very effective. The greatest killer, the single greatest demand right now on the battlefield as far as Western materiel supporting Ukrainians is the old Copperhead round, because it can't be spoofed by electronic warfare counters. And you know, when we are fighting near peer or pacing competitors that are leveraging the same technological advantage, at least again at within the same band of performance as us, then having that, you know, we talk about in the military, having the analog backstop or being able to revert back to older technologies, proven technologies. I just want to make sure we don't lose sight of that.
If I could just throw on something on Colonel Sullivan's comment, I made mention in my piece at War on the Rocks, the lessons from Ukraine are kind of important. The value of decentralized authorities, the linkages between a very entrepreneurial, savvy group of folks that kind of operating forward, the degree of adaptation between industry and operating forces is just, you know, phenomenal there, because of an act of necessity that, you know, we don't see very much of, but we've seen in Iraq, 20 years ago as well. There's definitely some lessons there. I hope we pick up. And I think folks like Anduril and Palantir are representing that kind of thought process in the United States right now.
Well, to sort of close out, because I'm conscious of the time, and I know you all are busy people with other things on your schedule that are probably approaching quite quickly, I want to kind of end in sort of a classic AAR fashion of sustains and improves, right? If you kind of highlight one thing that you think that the NDS does quite well, and one thing that maybe you wish it had done better or differently, and to give you a sense of kind of what I'm thinking about, I'll tell you. The first thing that I thought when I read it is that this actually provides a pretty coherent framework within which to understand the decision-making that the Defense Department under this administration is making. The things that it does are largely explained by the framework that this NDS provides. Now, what I thought it didn't do as well is, you know, we've talked, it's come up several times in this discussion that this is a summary of the classified version of the NDS. It's going to be shorter. There are going to be some details that are not included. I think there's probably a lot of stuff that is in that classified version that could have been in this unclassified version. So the defense industrial base section, for instance, it's less than a page long. So you can't cover everything, but it didn't discuss raw materials at all, rare earth minerals and things like that. And the administration is doing a lot of things on those fronts. I think if you actually look at the numbers, I'm not sure that it's enough, at least in the next handful of years, to be able to kind of overcome the problems that we face with regard to rare earth access and manufacturing. But that's sort of something that I think it did well and something that I wish it had done a little bit better. And in the absence of any non-arbitrary order, I'm just going to go left to right on my screen. And Pat, if we could start with you.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I agree with your assessment. I mean, I give the administration credit for, you know, putting out a document that's a confident expression of, you know, how they see, again, exercising their prerogative, America's place in the world and how it's going to advance its interests. You know, I was, it actually incorporates what, perhaps not exactly in form, but certainly in function, what Ali Wynn was advocating when he published America's Great Power Opportunity a couple of years ago, saying, hey, we can't be like responsive to our competitors, particularly when you consider that China, unlike, you know, the Soviets back during the Cold War, they were never ascendant militarily or economically. That's not the case with a rising China. And so, you know, the risk you run if you're constantly responsive to the threats that you're seeing from them is that you actually lose further position. So you just stake a position and, you know, and claim it, and, you know, where it poses competition, you face that competition head on. But otherwise, you know, you should be all about, again, place in the world and, you know, securing that. And so I using the AR language, I think that's a sustain. As far as improve, you know, irrespective of what we think politics are and how politics are represented in this document. In the end, political decisions are simply about the irrevocable commitment of resources. And until we see the virtuous linkage of this document to those resource decisions again, the assessment is incomplete.
Mark, any final thoughts on what this document does well and what you would have liked to have seen differently?
Yeah, I think what we've heard makes a lot of sense. It's quite good about setting priorities and about its alignment with the White House. There's very little gap between them. On the other hand, as others have said, you know, that's it lays out the ends pretty well. The ways and the means are very uncertain. And of course, once you get into those details, that's when things get really controversial. You talk about restructuring our commitment to Europe. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean we're going to have, you know, we're going to move forces more into Eastern Europe out of Central Europe? Well, that would make a lot of sense. Are we going to pull half of our forces out? Well, there'd be a lot of controversy there. Same thing in the Pacific. So as I say, the devil's in the details, and we really need the details.
And Frank, over to you.
Well, again, like everybody else, I like the framework. It's understandable. It's clear. I think the prioritization is logical. The part I like the least is probably some of the language about China and China's expectations. It comes across a little naive because it's probably aimed at them and our allies out there. But it has an expectation of accommodation with China that I think is quite naive and not where Xi and the PRC is going. The one exception in that, I think the theory of success of the strategy of denial in the first island chain makes sense to me, given the geography, given the technologies and the defense balance shifts I think that exist. I thought that part was pretty good, but the rest of the China discussion was naive at best.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you again for joining me. It's been a fascinating discussion for me. I trust it will be for listeners as well. I could continue it happily for some time, but we're very quickly approaching the 90 minutes that I begged each of you to give to me this morning. So Frank, thank you for joining me.
Great to be here. Thanks for the invite again.
Mark, thank you.
Yep. Appreciate the invitation, and I hope the listeners find our discussion useful.
And Pat, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, John. Thanks, Frank. Thanks, Mark, and thanks to all the listeners.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.